Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. In a few weeks, a U.S. district judge will hold a hearing on a Michigan case that challenges the state's constitutional ban on gay marriage. On today's show, we'll explore the implication the case could have in Michigan and across the nation. But first, a man from Flint, Michigan, has been held prisoner in Iran for 2 years. Amir Hikmati traveled to Iran to visit his grandmother in 2011. He was seized by the Iranian government and imprisoned. They accuse Hikmati, a former Marine, of spying for the CIA. He and the U.S. government deny that. U.S. Representative Dan Kildee has been leading an effort calling for the Iranian government to release Hikmati, and he joins us now. Congressman, the new Iranian president, Hassan Rouhani, has been involved in what's being described as a charm offensive, softening the rhetoric a bit, suggesting a meeting with President Obama. How does this new tone affect the effort calling for the release of Amir Hikmati?
Well, you know, it provides us with an opening. We're not sure how seriously we can take the new Iranian rhetoric, but this would be, we think, a tangible demonstration. Freeing Amir Hikmati would be a tangible demonstration that the Iranian people, the Iranian government, are serious about rejoining the international community. So, you know, we'll see. But it's hopeful that those overtures are being made. And we just learned today that Secretary of State John Kerry will be meeting with the Iranian foreign minister on Thursday. So these are positive developments, although small steps.
President Rouhani speaks to the U.N. General Assembly in New York tomorrow. Is there any hope of some kind of announcement about Hikmati during the visit?
I don't think so. I think from our point of view, we're just really hoping that we can use this visit to make the case that Amir Hikmati, you know, has been unfairly held, unjustly held, and should be brought home. But I suspect that the president's speech tomorrow will be on broader tones. Hopefully taking a step toward the global community. If Amir's case can be elevated to his attention, then we think we have a chance sometime, you know, in the coming, perhaps coming months to see a potential release. But, you know, that's only hope at this point in time.
Recently, a letter written by Amir Hikmati was smuggled out. In it, he asks the U.S. government to reject a deal the Iranian intelligence wants to do, that is, exchanging him for two Iranian prisoners. Hikmati called it, quote, a ridiculous proposition, end quote. Should there be a deal for Hikmati's release, or should the U.S. government reject it, as Hikmati has suggested?
Well, you know, of course, I'll leave that to the State Department and to the White House. But, you know, what I think Amir was communicating is that he's innocent and he shouldn't be treated as if he could be traded for others that, you know, that have tried to do harm. So I understand his perspective. Our hope is that his freedom will be based on the realization by the state of Iran that they need to take a step toward the global community. And on humanitarian grounds, if nothing else, Mr. Hikmati's father is quite ill, and we just want to have him come home.
You've started a Facebook page called Free Amir Hikmati. There are a number of photographs of members of Congress holding a Free Amir bumper sticker, 64 Republicans and Democrats. What kind of effect do you think that might have in influencing the Iranians?
Well, the reason that I asked my colleagues in Congress to take those photos, and we organized that last week, is to make sure that the Iranian government, particularly those that are visiting the United States, who follow social media, we know they do, that they know that the American people and the representatives of the American people are paying attention. We are watching. And if Amir's case is elevated to that standing, and a overture by the part of the Iranian government by freeing Amir would, I think, represent a tangible step in our direction. So we just want to make sure that they know that the world is watching, but particularly members of Congress from across the country are paying attention to what they do.
U.S. Representative Dan Kildee is leading an effort calling for the Iranian government to free Amir Hikmati. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
There's a new report on lobbyists' spending in Lansing. The Michigan Campaign Finance Network has looked at the numbers, and the big change? Free lunches for legislators, up 48% from last year. Joining us is Rich Robinson of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network to talk about what he's found. Now, Rich, I want to get to the increase in the free meals for legislators in a bit, but really, that's chicken feed compared to the amounts of money lobbyists get to try to influence lawmakers. You looked at the top 200 lobbyists. Who tops the list? What kind of money are we talking about?
Well, the top of the list is governmental consultant services. They spent $983,000 on lobbying expenditures in the first 7 months of 2013. GCSI has been the top lobbyist for some number of years, and it's an historical fact that the multi-client lobbying firms are always at the top of the
list. Okay, let's define that, because we toss that term multi-client lobbyist around a lot. How does that differ from other kinds of lobbyists?
Well, the multi-client firms represent an array of clients, presumably not in conflict on any one matter of public policy that's being considered by the legislature, but they are professional advocates who handle any number of issues. On the other hand, you have the interest groups who represent themselves as lobbyists. So the top single interest group on this list is the Michigan Health and Hospital Association. They came in sixth for spending for the first 7 months at $300,000.
I saw that another multi-client firm, the Michigan Legislative Consultants, reported an increase of nearly 204% over last year. Do we know what's going on there?
Well, I don't. It was certainly an interesting fact that I saw in these data. And while they're ascending, some of the other prominent multi-client firms are down significant amounts, 20 to 30%. You know, this is one of the inherently unsatisfying parts of doing this particular analysis. These multi-client firms are required to list the names of their clients, but they're not required to report how much they spend representing any client on any issue. And this contrasts, for example, with what is required to be reported by federal lobbyists or in the state of Wisconsin. Lobbyists are required to state an interest in a bill or a budget or a legislative or a regulatory matter before they begin lobbying, and then they report how much they're spending on that particular issue. So we know who the big multi-client firms are. We have a list of who their clients are, but we don't know how much they're spending to represent any one of them, and we don't really know how much is being spent on any one issue.
I looked at your list of legislators who ate and drank at least $1,000 on lobbyist tabs in the first 7 months of this year. 16 legislators in all made the list, 11 Republicans, 5 Democrats. Only one of the leaders made the list, Senate Majority Leader Randy Richardville. Was there any rhyme or reason or something in common among the others who dined on the lobbyist dime?
It's not obvious to me if there is something about this. On one hand, we might imagine that these are people who can get things done. The advocates desire to spend time with them and explain their issues and so forth. I've heard different reporters talk about legislators trolling for a free meal.
And so who's willing to put their hand out, right?
Kind of that way, yeah. And as crude as that sounds, that's how it's been described to me by journalists who spend time around the restaurants and bars in the evening in Lansing.
Now, you have noted in the past that 2012 was a record year. So far this year, the lobbying effort is down slightly. It's down, what, 1.7%? Do we know how these lobbyists use this money?
There are really three categories that are reported to the state. One is what they spend on hospitality, food and beverages, travel and accommodations. Another category is what they spend on what we could call grassroots lobbying, direct mail to the public. And the truth of the matter is very few of these lobbying entities report that. And it's interesting to me that, for example, there were a lot of billboards around the state encouraging senators to support the Medicaid expansion. I would have thought that would have been reported in that category of advertising, but it really wasn't. It didn't show up there. Very little is ever reported in that category. And then the third category is called other, and basically what that covers is the cost of the lobbyists, the cost of those individuals who sit down and meet with office holders and administration officials and try to make the case for their particular policy interest.
So most of this is pretty opaque. I mean, if you're seeing billboards, but you're not seeing any reporting about advertising on billboards, there's a lot to be desired in finding out how money's being spent to influence politicians.
Well, that's right. And historically, as these 50-state studies are done as to transparency and campaign finance or lobbying, Michigan always shows up poorly on those lists, and this is the reason. We have the broad outlines of what's going on, but we really don't know the important details that we should know.
What kind of problem does that cause for government overall?
I think it's important for citizens to recognize that matters of public policy just don't appear out of the vapors or came to some legislator in their sleep overnight or something like that. They're propelled by highly paid advocacy. And it would be important for citizens to understand what the legislative agenda is, to know who's driving that agenda, both through campaign finance contributions as well as their lobbying expenditures.
Rich Robinson is the executive director of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. Rich, as always, thank you very much for explaining this to us.
Thanks very much, Lester.
Still to come, state and national Republicans descended upon Mackinac Island this past weekend. Zoe Clark and Rick Kluter were with them. They're our It's Just Politics team. We'll talk in 20 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. And I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. On October 16th, U.S. District Judge Bernard Friedman will be hearing a case which challenges Michigan's constitutional ban on gay marriage. Now, the case didn't start out that way. It started out as a court case to simply protect the futures of these three little kids.
How old are you?
Three.
Three? What's your name?
Jacob.
Jacob? Yeah. How old are you?
I'm big. My name is Nolan.
And how old are you?
Four.
Ah, nice to meet you.
Now, these three really don't understand such things as government, lawyers, and courts. They only know they have a happy home with their two moms.
I am April DeBoer, and my daughter, Ryan DeBoer Rouse.
And I'm Jane Rouse, and my sons are Nolan DeBoer Rouse and Jacob DeBoer Rouse.
Now, DeBoer and Rouse wanted to jointly adopt their kids to better protect their futures. The state of Michigan argued, no way, they can't. They're not married. Their case has become the most anticipated development in lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people's rights in Michigan. They're involved in a federal court case that challenges the state's constitutional amendment that bans same-sex marriage. The two women explained they had no intention to challenge the gay marriage ban. Jane Rouse says that's something the judge suggested.
So what Judge Friedman said was basically looked at the state and said, so this hinges on marriage. And the state said yes, and he said, so what it sounds like to me is you guys need to challenge the marriage amendment. And we all kind of looked at each other and went, he just did not suggest that we challenge gay marriage. And he did.
You two weren't looking for this fight. It came to you, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah.
We were not looking for the marriage amendment fight. This has never been about us getting married. This has been about our rights and our children's rights and protecting them. You know, it's one thing when you're looking at second parent adoption. You know, this is about the kids. People see it about the kids. When you start talking about the marriage amendment, it's more about our relationship and what we want. And that gets a little bit scarier because people have, you know, a little more... They're a little more opinionated about a marriage, a gay marriage, than they are about children having two parents.
To talk about this case and other LGBT rights issues are Emily Devendorf, who is Managing Director of Equality Michigan, and Jay Kaplan, who is Staff Attorney for the American Civil Liberties Union of Michigan. Thanks for coming in, you guys. So let's talk about this case a little bit. Jay, let's start with you. Why is this case filed by DeBoer and Rouse being watched so closely?
Well, because it hinges on whether or not Michigan's amendment, constitutional amendment, which denies gay couples the right to get married, whether or not that's constitutional, and it will have an impact because it's a federal challenge against a prohibition on the fundamental right to marry. So everybody will be watching to see how Judge Friedman decides.
Now, if the court were to decide Michigan's constitutional amendment banning same-sex marriage is invalid, what would happen in Michigan?
Ultimately, the case will be decided in the federal appellate courts with regards to the right to marry, all the way up to possibly the United States Supreme Court.
So let's stop right there. So Michigan was one of like 13 states in 2004 which had this constitutional amendment. Each state had a constitutional amendment to ban same-sex marriage. Would all of those states be affected?
No. If for a federal district court decision, it would only impact Michigan. For the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, that would cover the states of Michigan, Ohio, Tennessee, and Kentucky that are part of the Sixth Circuit. Only a case that would go up to the United States Supreme Court would affect all of those states. But obviously, any federal challenge now on the issue of marriage equality can have an impact on efforts all across the country.
So this is going to take probably years before we find out anything. In the meantime, Emily, what do groups like Equality Michigan do? What are you advising people who'd like to get married and like to have it recognized in Michigan? And what kind of prep do you do in case everything went the way of the LGBT community?
Yes, Equality Michigan expects that the LGBT community, our partners and our families, that we need to keep on keeping on, that we need to keep the pressure on. And that means continuing to fight through the legislature and try to pass public policy that is equal and fair for LGBT citizens, as well as to try to treat the symptoms of the disease of discrimination by providing for our victim services departments that help the LGBT community, and also to build a really strong, robust marriage equality movement in Michigan, which Equality Michigan is intent on doing within the next year and a half so that we can win at the ballot in 2016.
I want to talk to you about the definition of marriage just a little bit. The state filed in the case arguing that limiting marriage to heterosexual unions is important to regulate sexual relationships between men and women so that the unique procreative capacity of such relationships benefits rather than harms society. Now, I'm not a lawyer. I don't know what that means. But when I hear the state is regulating sexual relationships, I get a little concerned about something like that. What does that mean, first of all, Jay?
Well, there's very little validity in that argument because the state doesn't regulate sexual relationships between opposite-sex couples, and denying same-sex couples in a committed relationship the fundamental right to marry does not further procreative efforts of heterosexuals, nor does it stop that. We don't condition the legal right to a civil marriage on whether or not a couple is going to have children or is able to have children.
Now, when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled earlier this year regarding the Defense of Marriage Act and regarding the estate case involving Edie Windsor, there was some writing about what is marriage. Emily, what did the Supreme Court say in its decisions?
Yes, the Supreme Court ruled that DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, violated, and these are their words, the basic due process and equal protection principles. The court decision in Windsor acknowledged that marriage is not inherently defined by the sex or sexual orientation of the couple, and the court recognized that marriage is a way for couples, including same-sex couples, to define themselves by their commitment to each other and to live with pride in themselves and their union and in a state of equality with all other married persons. And that is to say, the Supreme Court of the United States defined marriage not as being between one man and one woman, but being an institution of providing stability to our partners, to our families, a way to care for those in our lives that we love.
So now we have this situation where the federal government does, at least for taxes and spousal benefits, recognize same-sex marriage in states that allow it. Some states do, but the majority of states do not. So we've got this real quilt patch arrangement in the United States. Some of the same-sex couples I've interviewed are waiting for the results of the DeBoer-Rouse case or the 2016 initiative to decide whether they actually even stay in Michigan anymore or go somewhere that's more friendly to them. How might that affect Michigan and how people view Michigan?
Well, I think, you know, it's very telling that we've seen a loss in terms of population, especially young people, college-educated young people leaving our state. I think when we send a message with our policies that you're not included or you're not considered to be equal to me or you're not entitled to the same dignity that my family is or my relationship is, people don't want to stay here and they also don't want to come here. Even aside from the issues of fairness and treating people with dignity, there's a strong economic argument that can be made for our state. I know the governor was quoted as saying, you know, with regards to this issue, he's focusing on the economy. Well, there's an economic issue here. The states that do allow same-sex couples to marry, they've seen, you know, hundreds of million dollars in additional revenue coming to their state and people wanting to be in those states. I mean, look at Illinois. If Illinois by this fall allows same-sex couples to get married, that's less than, what, 4 hours away from Ann Arbor? People are going to start to reconsider, you know, do we want to stay here? Do we want to wait for this thing where our relationships aren't being recognized, where we're not being afforded and accorded the same kind of recognition by the state that even the federal government gives to us?
That's Jake Kaplan with the ACLU, and we also have Emily Devendorf with Equality Michigan. Same question to you. What kind of impact will these decisions, if we continue to drag our feet on this idea of marriage equality, as some call it, or abolishing this amendment of the Constitution that bans same-sex marriage, if there is no progress on those two fronts from your perspective, what will that mean to Michigan and the view of Michigan from outside?
Yes, as both a victim services organization and also one that does political work for the LGBT community, we hear very regularly that LGBT families do not feel safe and supported in Michigan and feel like they have to go elsewhere. The economic argument that we make when we talk about attracting the best and brightest and holding on to our college graduates, it is based on the fact that those that go into the much coveted STEM fields, the science, technology, engineering, and mathematics that Michigan would like to grow and really be dominant in, those that go into those fields tend to be attracted to states and municipalities that have open and diverse communities that protect their citizens. They want to be in a place where the culture is progressive and is conducive to the corporations, the business, and the government caring for its citizens.
There's a lot of discussion about gay marriage. It's the hot button topic right now. But I wonder if that doesn't pull attention away from other issues. In this state, it's legal to fire someone because they're gay or even if they just seem gay or because of their gender expression. LGBT people can be denied housing in many circumstances. They can be denied service in a restaurant or a hotel. The anti-gay rights folks say business folks should be protected from being forced to serve or hire lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender people if that would violate the business owner's own religious convictions or moral principles. So where are we in that debate? We're basically talking about the Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act and whether LGBT community members should be protected under that Civil Rights Act. Emily, let's start with you on that.
Yes, what's interesting is the business community has already stepped up to the plate on this one. More than half of all Fortune 500 companies already offer domestic partner benefits to their employees. They already make sure that their employees are protected by non-discrimination policies provided by the corporation. But they are shouldering the burden. They are shouldering the burden of creating an environment that is safe and that protects their employees. And they can only go so far to protect their employees and their employees' families, which doesn't necessarily create the kind of protection that makes a family, an LGBT family, or those that we talked about earlier, that those young professionals that want a diverse community, to want to stay in that community where that Fortune 500 company would like to grow. That means that our businesses are wanting to see the government step up, the government to make the decision to do what is best for business, what is best for Michigan, and that is to provide for everybody equally so that we will not have that economic stability. And we need to see that happen. As much as we need to see marriage equality happen, we need to make sure that somebody can't get married on Friday and then come to the office with the picture from their wedding on Monday and be fired for who they love.
Jay, let's talk about that concern about those who oppose gay rights or gay marriage. We've heard the story about the wedding bakery. We've heard the stories about the wedding photographers who didn't want to in states that have passed these laws. And they found that they were either, they say, driven out of business because of their opposition to gay marriage, or that they felt like they were being discriminated against because they held these beliefs. How do we find balance in that area?
Well, I think we have a history of balance in this area. We certainly, you know, our Constitution certainly protects the right to religious beliefs and freedom of religion, and it deals with religious activity. When you engage in non-religious commercial activity like a business, a photography business, or a bakery, you're subject to various laws and regulations, health code regulations, building code regulations, payroll taxes, as well as civil rights laws. And you don't get an exemption for non-religious activity to discriminate based on a religious belief. I mean, I could turn around that equation and say, what if the baker didn't want to bake a cake for a biracial couple because it violated their religious beliefs for someone who's African-American and Caucasian to marry?
But Jay, we're not talking about putting a whites-only sign out. We're talking about putting a straights-only sign out, and there's no protection in the state for that.
Well, when we talk about civil rights protections, we hear from opponents saying that we don't want to see these categories codified in law because it will violate my religious beliefs to discriminate. Everyone has a right to believe in what they believe. They don't necessarily have a right to discriminate under the law or under our Constitution.
Let's talk about codifying some of the religious liberties protections you're talking about in law. The legislature is considering legislation that would protect religious liberties of some groups, some of which are on state contracts, saying their religious convictions can be used beyond state guidelines to make decisions in placing children in foster homes or adoptions. You've both testified and heard testimony on this issue this session and past sessions of the legislature. Will the state codify religious convictions in state contracts?
I hope not. I hope not, because basically what this piece of legislation is doing is saying allow us to discriminate, allow us to pass over what might be in the best interests of children in order to promote a particular religious viewpoint. And once again, these are agencies that are receiving state dollars to do the work and the responsibility of the state. They are government actors. They're government agents. And we have a little thing in our Constitution called separation of church and state. The government's not in the business of promoting one particular religious viewpoint over the other. I hope they don't become law, because really who gets hurt are children who linger in foster care or linger in the state system who need a placement.
2013 has been a fascinating year because we have seen LGBT civil rights move astonishingly fast, astonishingly quickly compared to other civil rights issues throughout history. Are we starting to get ahead of society, getting out in front of the people's will, or are you still backed by the polls, which show how people feel one way or the other about LGBT rights?
I would say in Michigan, we're still experiencing a crisis of leadership. We never want to discount the progress that's being made nationally because we are so grateful for it. And as we saw with the striking down of DOMA and the IRS decisions recently, that there will be relief provided to Michigan citizens as a result of federal changes. However, as long as Michigan does not make progress itself, as long as Michigan citizens are still living in this void of protections, we really do not represent the forward motion of the rest of the country. And we are at risk of losing Michigan citizens, which doesn't just hurt our economy. It means that we are every day, again, harming Michigan citizens. So I don't want to get too caught up in celebrating the national progress. We should be grateful for it, but we should also be recognizing that that isn't necessarily happening at home until we demand that our leaders represent our values and make decisions on our behalf.
Jay, are the things that the ACLU would like to see and the things that groups like Equality Michigan, are you guys getting ahead of the people's will or not?
I don't believe so. When you look at the polling, majority of Michiganders do favor civil rights protections for LGBT people. They are in favor of marriage equality. Where the disconnect is, we continue to elect leaders to make policy decisions who aren't in sync with those feelings. It's a very exciting time right now, what's happening, the momentum. But we have so many challenges in Michigan. We have one of the most broadly prohibitions on not only on marriage equality, but on relationship recognition. We have court decisions that deny the existence of our relationships and our families. And once again, we lack civil rights protections against discrimination. So we need to take care of all those things.
Jay Kaplan is a staff attorney for the American Civil Liberties Union of Michigan. Emily Devendorf is managing director of Equality Michigan. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you, Lester.
Thank you.
Still to come, Michigan wines are really making a name for themselves outside of the state. In 15 minutes, we'll talk to one connoisseur who's not the least bit surprised. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. The co-hosts of It's Just Politics were hanging out with 1,500 Republicans this past weekend. Joining us to talk about what they learned at the Mackinac Republican Leadership Conference are Rick Pluta, Capitol Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network, and our own political junkie here at Michigan Radio, Zoe Clark. So lots to talk about, but let's start with the out-of-state Republican visitors who were kind of testing the water for a run at president. Who showed up? What'd they have to say?
Well, Rand Paul, Bobby Jindal, John Thune, Scott Walker, those were the big ones, all there and doing their early audition for the presidential stage, if that's how things play out.
Karl Rove was also there to talk a little bit of politics, and there were also pollsters throughout the weekend. So it's basically this big unifying event. Big names come in, like you said, Lester, 1,500 Republicans. And yes, a lot of these folks were possibly candidates for 2016, the presidential race. But interesting to note, this conference began, they hold it every 2 years since 1953. No one who has spoken at this conference has actually gone on to become president.
I understand there's a little flap with Rand Paul and the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare.
Yeah, that's true. It's sort of interesting that congressional Republicans showed up on Saturday, fresh off that vote to link defunding Obamacare to the continuing budget resolution, basically saying defund Obamacare or we're headed toward a federal government shutdown. And they were widely applauded for that. But Rand Paul, when he was talking to reporters, and then he repeated it again in his address to the conference, said that it's probably too late for that. And what Republicans could really best hope for is making some changes to Obamacare, improving Obamacare to make it more to the liking of conservatives. And that got some people actually more in other parts of the country kind of hot and bothered. And that played out on the Sunday morning talk show. Certainly what's going to happen next now that this is in the Senate. But Rand Paul at least said it seems to be headed toward a conference committee and negotiations, and that word, compromise.
Ahead of the Mackinac Republican Leadership Conference, there was some talk that there might be some Tea Party groups flexing their muscle. They'd have a little influence on what was happening and what was decided. Was there much evidence of that?
Well, right. I mean, and this is sort of this story that we've all been focusing on over the summer, this sort of intra-party fight between, you know, what you want to maybe call the establishment Republicans here in Michigan and then the Tea Party. And really what we've seen this play out over is the Medicaid expansion, something that Governor Snyder was for. And the Tea Party and Tea Party lawmakers are not happy with that. So there's a gentleman by the name of Wes Nakagiri. He's there. He wants to challenge Lieutenant Governor Kelly to say, look, you know, we don't like the policies. We think you're too moderate, Governor and Lieutenant Governor. So he was there. He was roaming the halls. But I think we all were just sort of thinking, ooh, maybe there was going to be something, that something might come up.
Well, would there be something like when Governor Snyder, Lieutenant Governor Kelly were introduced, that there were boos in the audience or something like that?
Right. But we didn't see anything of that.
Although, strangely, Wes Nakagiri did schedule an event in Mackinac City immediately prior to the conference. And agenda. That strangely, oddly developed some issues with a permit or something like that, and he was forced to cancel it. Just a coincidence, no doubt.
Yeah, there was quite a bit of fizzle in that way. There was also talk all week, actually for a couple weeks, that the One Tea Party group was actually going to announce a primary challenger, Governor Snyder, Friday morning. There was even a countdown on this website. 9 a.m. was when the announcement was going to be. Mm-hmm. Well, that fizzled also.
Wah,
wah. Wah, wah, wah.
I have to ask you, though, I mean, targeting the lieutenant governor just seems like an odd pick of all the offices you could pick. And why Brian Kelly in particular? Because let's face it, he's kind of conservative.
Right. And this has way more to do with messaging than it does with actually Brian Kelly. I think the Tea Party wants to show a message. They want to show we are powerful and influential. And this goes to actually how LGs are made okay to be part of the ticket. You know, usually we think of it as the executive gets to pick who his running mate, her running mate is going to be. But how it works here in Michigan is delegates, that the state delegates actually have to okay that choice. So the idea among the Tea Party is, hey, we can show how influential we are if we kick out who the governor wants and have one of our own candidates, one of our own people.
Also, the Tea Party is acknowledging a reality, a political reality, which is that they can do at a Republican convention because they've been able to get delegates there and to you know, dominate and influence those conventions. They can do it at a Republican convention. What they could not necessarily do in the arena of a primary or a general election, where there will be even, you know, more people involved.
And to that regard, we should also mention that Kelly did spend the weekend glad hand. He was out full force. I mean, I think he was even made to be a bigger figure to the folks that were there than Snyder. And a lot of people introduced him as the conservative voice within the administration.
I was going to say, I always thought that his first name was Brian, but apparently his given name by his parents is Conservative Voice Brian Kelly.
Conservative voice of the Snyder administration, Brian Kelly.
So all that glad-handing, there was a straw poll. How'd Kelly do? And how many of these Republicans at the Mackinac meeting will actually be nominating the candidates at the summer convention?
Well, I guess the last first, that these are exactly the kind of people who become convention delegates, that they're actually motivated enough to go and, you know, pay the freight and buy a ferry ticket and rent a hotel room on Mackinac Island, which isn't exactly cheap, and to go and to be informed and inspired. So these are the people who, you know, not only get out, but get out early. It's a very committed group of people. About one third of them actually voted in the straw poll. And, you know, what we saw was 85-86% of the people who voted voted for Brian Kelly to be lieutenant governor, which, you know, I mean, overall probably bodes pretty well for his prospects to remain on the ticket.
Governor Rick Snyder is still being a little coy about whether he'll run for re-election, although there seems to be little doubt that he'll run. Democrat Mark Schauer is out there raising money and campaigning. Why is the governor not an announced candidate yet?
That does seem to be the question, and it was the question on a lot of minds. In fact, Rick and I both asked the governor that very same question when we sat down with him. His line is that it'd be premature, that it would shift the focus, that there is still a fall legislative agenda, and that the second that he jumps in and says it's official, then suddenly that's what the focus will be on rather than actual policy issues.
And there is a lot of truth to that, that it may seem like a kabuki dance, but the fact of the matter is that when you've got the job of governing, that you do have to accomplish it. And officially declaring yourself a candidate, formally declaring that the campaign has started, just completely changes that. I mean, that said, there's no doubt that he's running again, that there is a campaign video that says that Rick Snyder and Brian Kelly deserve four more years of doing the job. He invited people to sign nominating petitions that would put him on the August Republican primary ballot. So, I mean, if someone really wanted to push back and make the case that he's a candidate, there wouldn't be an effective or rational rebuttal.
So you were telling me that Greg McNeely with the Michigan Freedom Fund, which backed passing the right to work law in Michigan, is now calling for legislation that would repeal requirements that lawyers join the State Bar Association. He's describing it as sort of a right to work bill for lawyers.
Yeah, okay. Remember earlier I said the whole Tea Party insurgency fizzled? This was the bang. This was what none of us were expecting. interesting. There was a panel discussion about right to work, freedom to work, as many of the Republican attendees call it. And it was the bang that came out of the conference, surprising many.
And we should say that this did not happen in a vacuum. You will be shocked to learn that there's maybe some politics behind this, too. A few days ago, the State Bar of Michigan sent a letter to the Secretary of State's office asking for a reversal of an elections rule that allows independent committees that do some types of campaign spending to keep their donors secret. They call it dark money. So now the State Bar is going in on record and pushing to try and make these groups reveal the source of their money. And one of those groups that would be effective is an independent committee that's run by the State Chamber of Commerce, which, as you probably have surmised, is very much associated with the Michigan Republican Party. And so kind of as a response to that, it was, well, fine, State Bar, you want to start delving into political questions? We'll just throw a little right to work your way, too.
And final question. So what do 1,500 Republicans do for fun on Mackinac Island when they're not listening to speeches and designing political strategy?
Well, there is a rule about conventions on Mackinac Island, Lester, and that's what happens on Mackinac stays on Mackinac.
Probably a good idea when there are a bunch of reporters up there. So that's Rick Pluta. He's Capitol Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network and our own political junkie at Michigan Radio, Zoe Clark. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Lester.
Oh, you bet.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. So, go to New York City, visit a nice restaurant, and you might just find yourself looking over the wine list and find an entry that's a little bit surprising. A Michigan wine. Joining us is the chief restaurant critic and wine writer for Our Magazine, Chris Cook, who recently wrote about that little surprise. So, the old song suggests if you can make it in New York, you can make it anywhere. How close is Michigan to bringing its wines to the world?
Well, we're getting closer and closer. I mean, I think that one of the interesting things that's going on with Michigan is that we're going back to the future in certain areas. You know, our auto industry, as we all know, has been in decline. But agriculture, on the other hand, is sort of picking up, which is what we were before we were an auto state. And so some of these wineries have been making wine for a long time now, and they're entering them in international competitions. They're being seen elsewhere on the professional level, but not so much on the retail level or in restaurants. And finally, what we're seeing is the acknowledgement, I think, of a lot of Michigan wines as being not just great little cute wines in some state in the Midwest, but really competitive with other wines around the country.
What kind of wine might we find on a nice restaurant in New York City?
Well, what's happened here that makes us so interesting is that a very small Michigan winery by the name of Left Foot Charlie has appeared on a very important New York wine list. That wine list is it's actually on two restaurants, one called Terroir and the other one called Hearth. And Terroir and Hearth are really interested in the Riesling grape, and that being our most famous grape also. So Left Foot Charlie, which has been made here for a good 10 years by a guy named Brian Albrecht up in Traverse City, has been out and placed in competitions all over the place and won, and that wine has become known elsewhere much more than it is known in Michigan.
Aside from the big wine regions in California and New York, we know states such as Oregon, Washington have been getting recognition for a long time now. But there are some Midwest states, too, producing some really very good wines. I mean, Missouri is one I'm particularly familiar with. Iowa also has some wines. Where does Michigan fit into this new generation of wines outside of places such as California?
Michigan is now, I believe, the fourth or fifth, depending on whose numbers you use, largest producing wine state in the country. That has come about mostly in the last decade. We've gone from about 20 to 30 wineries a decade ago to now over 100. I think we're 101 or 102 at this point. And so what's happened is that wine has gotten a lot more competitive in a way in-state. Wineries are producing a lot more, but they're also benefiting from each other's experience in growing it in-state, and that's extremely important. And now we're somewhere, I believe it goes California, New York, Oregon, Washington, and then it's either Michigan or Missouri, followed by Virginia, Pennsylvania, and some other states. We've really moved up in that position, in that positioning.
I want to talk about some of the regions in Michigan. The southwestern part of the state has been a fruit-growing area. Like other states have started making wine from table grapes, I mean sweet wines. That's evolved over the time. Now we're seeing these great wines from the tart cherry country up in northwest Michigan, Leelanau Peninsula, Old Mission Peninsula. What separates these areas and climate and the kind of wines or the varietals that they're planting in southwest Michigan and northwest Michigan?
Well, a lot of it has to do with soil condition and growing conditions in terms of weather, climate up there. Climate in the Leelanau Peninsula is somewhat different from down in southwest, where it tends to be warmer. But they're also more protected in certain ways by what they call the lake effect in the winter months.
Right.
So they produce the same grapes in both locations, but we're beginning to see wines that are distinctly different in character. One of the winemakers tells me that there's such a variety in soil in Michigan that you can go 100 feet in one direction, 100 feet in the other, and plant the same grapes, and that you will have two completely different wines. He calls it the Burgundyization, if you will, of Michigan, in that Burgundy produces all those wonderful red wines, because they have such marvelous different soil patches very, very close to each other. Michigan's got a similar kind of a soil geographic base to it.
Slightly different climate, slightly many different kinds of soils, different conditions. You know, we get the hills of Leelanau and some rolling hills in southwest. I guess it all adds up. So you wrote in your piece in Our Magazine called Splashdown that Michiganders have an inferiority complex about making or doing anything well except for cars. How true is that these days?
Oh, I love that. Yeah, that's actually what I picked off there is a term that the Mexicans have. It's called malinchismo. And it basically suggests that anything that they do up north is better than what we do down here. I believe that Michigan has a bit of a malinchismo problem in that it's very hard to convince Michigan people that Michigan wines are as good as they are. Most of our wines are bought by Michigan because they're all sold in Michigan, and there is a certain base of support. But I think it's not
what you serve your out-of-state friends, baby, when they come to dinner.
Well, it should be, the fact that Left Foot Charlie is being sold in New York is a suggestion that we might want to start looking at this differently. And I really hope that that's what happens with this.
Chris Cook is chief restaurant critic and wine writer for Our Magazine. Chris, thanks for coming in and explaining.
Thanks for having me.
Here at Stateside, we always want to hear from you. What's on your mind? What stories do you want to hear more about? Let us know. Find us online at michiganradio.org. Just click on the link that says Stateside. You can also find us on Facebook. Search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. And we're also on Twitter, at Stateside Radio. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside is engineered by Bob Scon. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Mercedes Mejia, and Katie Suha. The program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Let's talk again tomorrow at 3:00.